This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years with the arrival of Anniversary Blend Coffee and Tea. Portland locations on the web at PEETS.com.
Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Monday, June 12, 2006. I'm LaToya Hudson.
And I'm Jim Thompson.
Loopholes in Oregon law allow campaigns to hide the identity of donors bankrolling efforts to the EGT initiative on this year's ballot. President Bush is gathering his top military and civilian cronies to advise him on plans for America's future role in Iraq. U.S. forces in Iraq have killed 7 people in a raid on what they claim was insurgent stronghold. Portland area weather, mostly cloudy with scattered showers at times heavy. Temperature in the 70s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, rain and a chance of thunderstorm, low in the 50s.
And good morning. From the Daily Astorian, we have this story. A rally for the river took place Saturday at the Columbia River Vision's office. Citizens and conservation groups marched down Commercial Street through Astoria to protest the siting of a liquid natural gas plant in their area. A grassroots coalition of organizations from Oregon and Washington opposed to the siting of liquefied natural gas plants on the Columbia River. Northern Star's application for an LNG terminal at Bradwood has been submitted to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The coalition will announce plans for a legal challenge. Members of the group have expressed concerns about the safety of LNG terminals, disruption of river traffic, diminished tourism, and loss of fishing grounds and salmon-rearing sites because of dredging for terminals. 4 companies are seeking to build LNG terminals, 2 in Warrenton, 1 at Port Westward near Clatskanie, and Northern Star's proposal for Bradwood.
Loopholes in Oregon law allows campaigns to hide the identity of donors bankrolling efforts to get initiatives on this year's ballot. At least 2 groups seeking to put measures before voters in November to allow a casino in Multnomah County and to limit state spending growth have been able to keep their backers secret. Campaigns to qualify at least 3 other proposals list their financial backers behind extra layer of paperwork, making it harder to learn who is paying to get those issues on the ballot. Those initiatives would affect property rights, the election of judges, and campaign finance rules. Oregon is one of 5 states with no limit on how much individuals or groups can contribute to campaigns. Instead, Oregon requires disclosure so voters know who is backing a campaign. But 3 holes in state campaign laws allow donors to bankroll expensive initiative campaigns without disclosing their identities. Donors who back measures can be kept confidential when their donations are used to gather signatures. Out of the state groups can pump money into candidates or initiative campaigns without disclosing who donated it. Only the chief petitioner committee for each initiative has reported its contributions and spendings during the signature gathering period. That means other groups that raise or spend money for the measure don't have to report the sources of that money until about 3 months after signatures are due. This from the Oregonian.
The public can hear advocates for health-related ballot measures proposed for the November 7th general election, according to the Salem Statesman Journal. The forum is sponsored by the union-backed Oregonians for Health Security, Oregon Action, and Jobs with Justice. It will be from 7 to 9 p.m. tomorrow at St. Andrew's Catholic Church. Spokeswoman Kathy Gauthier said that Oregonians for Health Security might sponsor additional forums for the November election, depending on how many health-related initiatives end up qualifying for the ballot.
At South Central Washington's Hanford Nuclear Reservation, government workers continue cleaning up the mess. Clearing debris, tearing down buildings, and freeing soil and groundwater of the toxic radioactive brew left from the 40 years of plutonium production for the nation's nuclear weapon arsenal. Since 1990, more than 2,300 people have sued over health problems they say were caused by exposure to radioactive emissions from Hanford. A judge dismissed 6 of his 12 initial cases. A jury rejected 4 more during 2 trials last year. Just 2 people who suffer from cancer won damages against the government and the contractors who managed the federal site at the time. The awards total about $550,000. Both sides have appealed all of the rulings. According to the Oregonian, the government has spent millions of dollars defending the cases. For some, that point and the plaintiff's lack of success at trial would raise questions about the viability of the remaining cases.
Nationally, for every 100 women who receive a bachelor's degree, 75 men earn one. Oregon's gender gap is narrower, but growing. In 2005, for every 100 women at Oregon universities who earned a bachelor's degree, 82 men got one. A decade ago, Oregon's female-male split was 50-50, according to the Oregonian. The trend continues this month, when 6 of 7 Oregon public universities will award more degrees to women than men. Only Oregon Institute of Technology will graduate more men than women. Men can expect to earn $1 million less on average over a lifetime without a college degree. The gender gap is widest among low-income students and is especially evident between female and male African Americans and Latinos.
According to a posting on Portland India Media, about 40 Olympia residents took to the streets last Friday to kick off the weekend of resistance against the Green Square with a street party and rally for civil liberties. As the event began, a police officer on a bicycle approached the mobile sound cart and threatened the people operating it with citations if they did not turn the TH volume down. The officer said that if he could still hear the audio 50 feet away, they would be ticketed for a noise violation. The volume was turned down a little bit, but the revelers dancing and marching in the streets could still hear the music well. The procession slowed traffic in both southbound lanes. People resisted the order to leave the streets, citing the First Amendment right to peaceful assembly. A police officer grabbed a man on a bicycle, and there was a struggle while the man got away, leaving the officer holding the man's backpack. The officer seemed to not want to escalate the situation and gave the backpack back to the man. At the rear of the column, an officer was trying to write a citation to a woman pushing a baby stroller. The woman asked why she was being singled out and if the officer intended to ticket everyone in the street. Around this time, more officers showed up. It was decided that the street party could have one lane in the street. No one was being detained and no one was ticketed.
A top U.S. official has described the suicides of 3 detainees at the U.S. base of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, as, quote, a good PR move to draw attention. Colleen Graffy told the BBC the deaths were part of a strategy and a tactic to further the jihadi cause, but taking their own lives was unnecessary. But lawyers say the men who hanged themselves had been driven by despair. A military investigation into the deaths is underway amid growing calls for the center to be moved or closed. Graffy said the 3 men did not value their lives nor the lives of those around them. Detainees had access to lawyers, received mail, and had the ability to write to families, so had other means of making protests, she said, and it was hard to see why the men had not protested about their situation. The men, 2 Saudis and a Yemeni, were found unresponsive and not breathing by guards on Saturday morning, said officials. They were in separate cells in Camp 1, the highest security section of the prison. There have been dozens of suicide attempts since the camp was set up 4 years ago, but none successful until now.
Federal officials are proposing that nearly all of Puget Sound, the waters of the San Juan Islands, and the U.S. half of the Strait of Juan de Fuca should be designated critical habitat for endangered orcas. While killer whales advocates hailed the extensive coverage and quick action taken by the National Marine Fisheries Service as a follow-up to last year's listing the orcas as endangered. Some question the proposal exemptions of all near-shore habitat. Kathy Fletcher, executive director of People for Puget Sound, said the federal agency sometimes takes years to designate critical habitat in the process for protecting endangered species. She said the large area covered by the proposal, more than 2,500 square miles of water, is good news as well. The critical habitat designation is still just a proposal. And there will be hearings next month in Seattle and Friday Harbor. The hope is to arrive at a final recommendation by November. Establishing a critical habitat for endangered species is the next step after listing the creature. Once critical habitat is established, all federal agencies will be required to consult with the Federal Fisheries Service to make sure their actions do not endanger the orcas or their habitat. This from the Seattle Post-Intelliger.
According to a story set for the front page of Sunday's New York Times, there are many lingering questions about the killing of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi due to conflicting accounts of what happened. The paper wonders how Zarqawi could have survived such a devastating attack, even for a few moments, and how the terrorist leader's head and upper body, quote, could have remained largely intact. Also, while initial reports from Iraq indicated that a child had been killed in the airstrike, the U.S. military denied that until today. With rumors circulating in the Iraqi news media that Mr. Zarqawi had begun to run from the house as the first bomb struck, American officials said Saturday that two military pathologists had arrived in Iraq to perform an autopsy on Zarqawi's body to determine the precise cause of his death. General Caldwell said the changing details were a result of the confusion typical in the immediate aftermath of military operations. This according to the New York Times.
Critics of the government's domestic surveillance program claim it violates the rights of free speech and privacy. The Bush administration says it is necessary and legal. Both sides are due in court today to argue the constitutionality of the program. American Civil Liberties Union has asked for immediate halt to the warrantless wiretapping program. U.S. District Judge Anna Diggs Taylor was to hear the case brought by the ACLU against the National Security Agency. The Bush administration has asked Taylor to dismiss the lawsuit, saying the litigation would jeopardize state secrets. But Taylor said she would first hear arguments on the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, despite the government's assertion that no court can consider the issues. The administration has acknowledged eavesdropping on Americans' international communications without first seeking court approval. Ann Beeson, the ACLU's associate legal director, says that, quote, the framers never intended to give the president the power to ignore the laws of Congress, even during the wartime and emergencies. She said no state secrets need to be revealed to litigate the case because the administration has already acknowledged the programs exist. The Center for Constitutional Rights has filed a similar lawsuit on the eavesdropping in federal court in New York.
Congressional Republicans killed a provision in an Iraq war funding bill that would have put the United States on record against the permanent basing of U.S. military facilities in that country. The $94.5 billion emergency spending bill, most of which will be blown on waging wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, is expected to be approved by Congress next week and sent to President Bush for signing into law. As originally passed by the House of Representatives, the Pentagon would have been prohibited from spending any of the funds for entering into a military basing rights agreement with Iraq. A similar amendment passed by the Senate said the Pentagon could not use the next round of war funding to, quote, establish permanent United States military bases in Iraq or to exercise United States control over the oil, infrastructure, or oil resources of Iraq. While the Pentagon does not necessarily plan to use any of the emergency funds to establish a permanent military presence in Iraq, congressional Democrats wanted Congress to be on record against such a long-term military arrangement. Next week, the House is scheduled to have a wide-ranging debate about the Iraq War, at which time Democrats are likely to raise this issue once again.
A computer hacker got into the U.S. agency that guards the country's nuclear weapons stockpile and stole the personal records of at least 1,500 employees and contractors. The target of the hacker, the National Nuclear Safety Administration, is the latest agency to reveal that sensitive private information about government workers was stolen. The incident happened last September, but top Energy Department officials were not told about it until this week, according to Reuters. The revelation prompted the chairman of the House of Representatives Energy and Commerce Committee to command the resignation of the head of the NNSA. The NNSA is a semi-autonomous arm of the Energy Department and also guards some of the U.S. military's nuclear secrets in response to global nuclear and radiology emergencies.
And President Bush is gathering his top military and civilian war advisors to plan the U.S. role in the country's future. The president planned 2 days of meetings at Camp David starting today. National security advisors will be on hand and top commanders in Iraq connected by video conference. White House officials have said announcements of force reductions are not expected, yet the top U.S. commander in Baghdad predicted on the eve of the meeting that coalition troops will gradually move out of the country in the coming months. Iraq's Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, took office last month and appointed the key final ministers last week. Bush has said the new government marks a new chapter in the U.S. relationship with Iraq. With Republicans worried about losing control of Congress in November's midterm elections, and most Americans saying they would like the troops to come home, Bush is under pressure. Only one-third of respondents to an Associated Press poll in early June supported Bush's handling of the situation, an all-time low. But he has been careful not to signal any troop reductions yet, continuing to say he will make those decisions when commanders in the field advise him to do so.
Members of the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist groups rallied at the site of the bloodiest day of the American Civil War this weekend, the first time a group has been given permission to demonstrate at the site. At the Antietam National Battlefield in Maryland, Union and Confederate forces clashed on September 17, 1862, leaving more than 23,000 people dead, wounded, or missing. The Klan's permit for Saturday's demonstration was the first to be granted at the National Park on the grounds of free speech.
Police in California just watched as some of the country's most notorious graffiti writers sprayed up a Caltrans maintenance yard in Los Angeles. But the artists aimed their spray cans at canvases and not on walls during Saturday's first annual West Coast Graffiti Party. And Caltrans, which spends millions of dollars cleaning up graffiti each year, sanctioned the event. Organizer Raul Gamboa, a well-known Los Angeles graffiti writer, said he stressed to Caltrans officials the need for legal venues for the art. Caltrans spokesman Judy Gish says the agency wanted to explore new ways to prevent the costly and ugly vandalism. Graffiti writers and fans who attended the party described graffiti as a street art integral to hip-hop culture and not vandalism.
The U.S. military has concluded its investigation into a video that appeared to show private security contractors shooting at civilian vehicles driving on highways in Iraq and determined that no one involved will be charged with a crime, according to Washington Post. The investigation began after the video was posted on an internet site, purportedly run by employees of Aegis Defense Services. Aegis is a London-based firm with a $293 million U.S. government security contract, the largest of any security firm working in Iraq. The scenes were aired widely on Arabic-language satellite television and prompted denunciation from several members of Congress. The military said it was investigating, as did Aegis. Keefe said that the alleged shooter in the video was determined to be South African and that the military would share the results of the investigation with British and South African authorities. Investigators said they believe that those officials will come to the same conclusion that Sid did, as the lack of probable cause to believe that a crime was committed.
Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The militant group created by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi issued a defiant declaration on an extremist website yesterday, vowing to, quote, prepare major attacks that will shake the enemy like an earthquake and rattle them out of sleep. Zarqawi died last Wednesday after U.S. airstrike near Bakuba, north of Baghdad, prompting speculations that the brutal network he founded would disband or merge with other Sunni extremist groups. The statement said the surviving leadership of the Iraqi affiliate of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda had met after Zarqawi was killed and, quote, agreed to continue jihad and not be affected by his martyrdom. The organization has strengthened its back, regained its footing, and has been renewed from fresh blood. Senior members of the group had been killed in the past, it said, but the group's ability to strike had not diminished. For those who were waging holy war for the sake of al-Zarqawi, al-Zarqawi is dead. But for those who were fighting for the sake of God, God is alive and eternal, it said. Meanwhile, at the weekend, reports said residents were fleeing Ramadi in the troubled Anbar province west of Baghdad, fearing a Fallujah-style onslaught by U.S. and Iraqi troops, and British troops fought a gun battle with insurgents in Amara, which led to 5 civilians dying and 12 others being wounded, according to The Guardian.
In a growing struggle for power in the Palestinian territories, Hamas said yesterday that it would boycott a referendum called by the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas over recognition of Israel and two-state solution. The political confrontation, which could bring down Hamas or Abbas, comes amid rising violence after Islamist group ended a ceasefire and fired rockets at Israel in retaliation for the killing of 7 members of a family, including 3 children, by Israeli shelling of the Gaza Strip. The killings provided a somber backdrop to the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's visit to Downing Street today, where he hopes to win Tony Blair's support for his realignment plan to redraw Israel's borders and annex the main Jewish settlement blocks within a few years. Yesterday, Mr. Olmert expressed deep regret over the deaths of innocent civilians, but the bloodletting continued as the Israeli Air Force killed 2 Hamas men after they fired a rocket in Israel. Another Hamas rocket badly injured a man in the Israeli town of Sderot. At the weekend, Abbas was called a referendum for July 26 after Hamas rebuffed his ultimatum to accept a document drawn up by the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The document agrees to a two-state solution and recognition of the Jewish state. Opinion polls suggest a clear majority of the Palestinians will back the prisoners' document.
Fears of an imminent offensive by the U.S. troops massed around the insurgent stronghold of Ramadi intensified Saturday, with residents pouring out of the city to escape what they describe as a mounting humanitarian crisis. U.S. and Iraqi forces have cordoned off the city. Airstrikes on several residential areas have picked up, and troops are in the streets with loudspeakers to warn civilians of a fierce impending attack. Thousands of families remain trapped in the city. Those who have fled say many can't afford to leave or lack transportation, whereas other families have decided to wait for their children to finish final examinations at school before escaping. Residents have been particularly unnerved by the recent arrival of 1,500 U.S. troops sent to reinforce the forces already stationed at the city. Street battles between troops and insurgents have been raging for months, but the troops' deployment left residents bracing for a mass offensive to take the town back from insurgents. The fearful city is haunted by memories of the battles that raged in nearby Fallujah in 2004. Determined to purge that city of insurgents, U.S. Marine and Army units lined up to the north and pushed south through the heart of Fallujah. They cleared one neighborhood after another in intense, constant street fighting. By the time the street sweep was over, the town was largely destroyed. This from the L.A. Times.
In Afghanistan, the worst 3 weeks of violence since the fall of the Taliban have left more than 500 people dead, according to the U.S.-led coalition forces. Fighting on Saturday killed 6 insurgents and 3 police officials said. Late Friday, a top Afghan intelligence agent narrowly survived a bomb attack on his convoy that killed 3 other people near the capital, Kabul. Much of the recent Taliban fighting is believed funded by the country's nearly $3 billion trade in opium and heroin. That's about 9% of the world's supply. The daily violence has raised fears of a Taliban resurgence almost 5 years after Islamic extremists were driven out by a U.S.-led invasion for harboring al-Qaeda.
And this just came in. The Supreme Court has just sent down a ruling that a Tennessee death row inmate can use DNA evidence to attempt to show his innocence 20 years after he was convicted of murdering a neighbor. The High Court's decision is significant because numerous exonerations in recent years of death row and other criminal defendants through DNA testing have raised concerns among civil libertarians, prosecutors, and Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens that an innocent person may be executed or already has been.
President Hugo Chavez is preparing his ragtag armies, just in case the United States invades Venezuela, according to an article set for Sunday's New York Times. Military drills and arms purchases are part of Chavez's rising military profile, and what he contends will be the training as many as 2 million citizens to fight a guerrilla war, in preparation for what Chavez claims is his threat of invasion by the United States. Officials at the U.S. Embassy in Caracas insisted that no such plans exist, but the denials do not appear to convince Chavez, who was briefly ousted in 2002 coup, tactically supported by Bush administration officials. While military analysts say Venezuela's upgrading of its arsenal is not unusual compared with arms purchases by neighboring countries, the United States has responded warily. It moved to block Venezuela's accusation of military aircraft from Spain and Brazil by denying export licenses for the transfer of U.S.-made components for the plane.
A controversial U.N. report that has been shelved for 18 months names and shames leading Afghan politicians and officials accused of orchestrating massacres, torture, mass rape, and other war crimes. The 220-page report by the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights, which The Guardian has obtained, details atrocities committed by communist, Mujahideen, Soviet, and Taliban fighters over 23 years of conflict. Originally scheduled for release in January of 2005, the report's publication has been delayed repeatedly due to sensitivities over identifying former warlords still in positions of power. Debate over the role of former warlords has grown more heated since anti-foreigner riots rocked Kabul 2 weeks ago, casting clouds over the $12 billion Western-funded reconstruction effort. European diplomats are angered that days after the riots, President Hamid Karzai appointed 13 former commanders with links to drug smuggling, organized crime, and illegal militias to senior positions in the police force. A European official said the 13 appointments had strained Mr. Karzai's relationship with foreign donors and further eroded his credibility with ordinary Afghans. A UN spokesman, Aileen Siddique, said the report had been presented to the Afghan government and may be released within a month, this according to The Guardian.
Pro-Welling nations look to set command a majority of the votes when the International Welling Commission, the IWC's, annual meeting began on Friday. Several countries which appear likely to vote with the pro-Welling bloc have joined the body in recent weeks. UK Marine Affairs Minister Ben Bradshaw said he is very concerned. A pro-Welling majority could lead to the scrapping of conservation and welfare programs, though not a return to full-scale commercial whaling. That would need 3/4 of the delegates to vote in favor, which is extremely unlikely. But a simple majority would be enough to end the IWC work on issues which Japan believes to be outside its remits, such as welfare and killing methods, whale watching, and anything concerning small cetaceans, such as dolphins. The potential for collision is higher at this year's meeting than it has been for decades.
And this has been the KBOO Morning News for Monday, June 12, 2006. Thanks for listening. Today's editor is Chris. Our engineer is Matt. KBOO volunteers edit and produce some of the tape stories you heard today. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Jim Thompson.
And I'm Latoya Hudson.
We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge on translator K246AA, and 100.7 in the Willamette Valley on translator K220HR. If you would like to volunteer in your community newsroom, call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202, or email at amnews@kboo.org.